Jean, and welcome to the Hmong Mental Health Podcast, where we encourage you to talk about mental health because it does exist in our community. We invite you to join us on this journey toward understanding and bettering our holistic well-being. We are your hosts from Vanguard Mental Health and Wellness Clinic. My name is Dr. Alyssa Kaying Vang.
I am Mosey Tao.
I am Chu Her.
And I'm Hua Vang.
We want to take a moment to remind our listeners that this podcast does not replace professional help. So if you are struggling with your mental health, please find a provider who specializes in treating mental health symptoms so that you can receive the ongoing support you need. Welcome back to the Hmong Mental Health Podcast. Thank you for joining us today. Today, we're going to be talking about a topic that is huge. And whenever we talk about mental health in the Hmong community, we cannot not talk about trauma. And this is because of our story as a Hmong community, our story of being refugees during the Vietnam War and how we have come to the United States and other host countries after the Vietnam War ended. Our story of being a people without a country, and even dating back to our ancestors in China, where we were oppressed and persecuted and pushed southward and displaced. And so the Hmong story is one that is filled with traumatic experiences. And so today, that's what we're going to be talking about, is trauma. How does it impact us as a people? So the historical trauma piece, the collective trauma. How does it impact us at the intergenerational and generational level? And how does it impact us individually? We recognize that trauma is a big topic that encompasses many different areas. We know that we cannot cover this in a short podcast. And so what we're going to try to do is cover some of the areas that more relates to the Hmong story and to our community. But first, before we dive into it, let's talk a little bit about what trauma is, because I think that right now, from my observation, trauma is a word that gets used so common nowadays, right? It's sort of like a loosely used word that many people use to describe difficult situation. So I want to bring this up for us to talk about, because that relates to a certain level of distress, right? But not necessarily traumatic. And perhaps even when people loosely use the word traumatized, it might be for situations that many might consider to be small. And so what are your thoughts on just how the word trauma is being used? And let's try to clarify that for our listeners.
I think when we as clinicians think about trauma, we think about, you know, the textbook definition about what's in the DSM-5, which is the diagnostic manual that therapists and psychiatrists and doctors use to diagnose individuals who have experienced, post-traumatic stress disorder. And so there's specific criteria where that individual has been exposed to, life-threatening experiences or has witnessed it. And so then if the individual meets those criteria, we make that diagnosis. However, it reminds me of the training that I went to in 2018 on the African American community and historical trauma. And the speaker was like, trauma is a fancy word for pain. And that really stuck with me because it's like, oh, that's so true. Because, when we go through traumatic experiences, it's the pain that we experience. And it's that experience that really came up unexpected for us, that we weren't prepared for. And so, like you mentioned, if something triggers us, then it reminds us or it brings us back to those memories where we experienced that pain, that trauma.
And I was just thinking, when you speak about pain, because I think that is what people recall, right, when they think about trauma. And probably why it's used so loosely sometimes is because they remember the feeling more so than thinking about, you know, criteria wise, like, mm-hmm. is it actually putting you into a place of fight, flight response mode, right? Where you really were really thinking that it was a trauma response. So I think when I think about that, and how society today, or like just how we are today, where we speak on that, it's important then to discern, like, well, was it actually like traumatizing for you? Or was it just a moment in time where maybe you felt a lot of anxiety that might not have been traumatizing, right? So it's about learning how to help them discern the difference then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think a big part of it is people's expectations of what is good mental health, right? It's me living my best life. And whenever there is a negative experience, we've come to adopt in this day and age that that negative experience that prevents me from living my best life is something traumatic. Mm-hmm. I didn't want it. It wasn't something I expected. It's a negative experience. Therefore, it's some form of trauma. Whether it is textbook to what we believe in psychology or what is clinical, we often then think that these negative experiences is some form of trauma. Like, for example, the mother situation where mom does something or say something that a child doesn't like. Oh, that was so traumatizing. Well, it's truly just something that happened out of expectation that makes someone have this negative experience in life. And I think over time, we've come to learn and understand trauma to be different from that clinical and that very PTSD type level to very more sometimes what we call little T trauma, right?
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if there's benefit for us to help differentiate that, right? Because are we then feeding into this idea of using that word so loosely that now it's very difficult? And now everybody feels like they're easily traumatized when in fact, when they enter into our clinical office, we kind of see that as, oh, you were in a highly distressful situation that caused a lot of anxiety, right? To your point. And not to invalidate their experience, but also to bring back and normalize that difficulties happen in our lives and not all of them are traumatizing, right? Because a psychologist once said that all trauma is stressful, but not every stress is traumatic. So the other thing that I was thinking about as we're talking about trauma in our Hmong culture is differences between historical trauma, intergenerational trauma, and psychological trauma. Can you guys talk a little bit about what your thoughts on historical trauma versus intergenerational trauma and psychological trauma?
Well, I think when we talk about historical trauma, it's usually it's an event that has, you know, happened that has affected, you know, a lot of people, right? And so not just families, but, you know, multiple families within a culture or, you know, within a society, however that is. And so this might be, you know, like war, this might be slavery, right? All of those things are what I would consider more historical trauma. And then when I think about family trauma or intergenerational trauma, that's more trauma patterns that are being passed down from families that might not necessarily fit for like the bigger group. Mm-hmm. So this might be, you know, family rules in the household where, you know, we don't talk about things in the family that might have been a trauma response at some point that has now become a family rule. Right? That we don't talk about stuff. And then psychological trauma, you know, I don't know if you both, I'm just talking, everybody you guys want to go to, you guys are more than welcome. Whereas I think, you know, psychological trauma is something that something has occurred to you. Maybe it's more like on an individual level. Mm-hmm. And now you are experiencing that trauma effect from it, right? So this might be like maybe abuse. This might be being assaulted. Those instances where it's more, I think, on an individual level, and we're thinking about your psychological state in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to add on something I've learned over the course of time about historical versus that intergenerational, one thing that I've learned that was interesting that I've picked up is that a lot of times historical trauma is looked at as being done to a group of people by an outsider, right? When we talk about oppression or slavery or war, right? That's a dominant population or something like that happening or doing or causing some form of trauma to that group of people. Whereas with that intergenerational trauma, a lot of the times it's within that group of people, right? From one generation of parents to their children and from that children to their next children, right? So that's within a group of people. And I think that's a big distinction for us because when we talk about Hmong people, right, when we talk about that historical trauma, right, that's very war-driven, right? And that's very us being not the dominant group, mm-hmm. right, but very a smaller group or a less population within society where we're on the short end. And I think when we talk then about that interracial drama, it's about how families and how over generations, Hmong people have dealt with that historical piece of not having a country or not being able to say we have land and then how we've adjusted and try to live life. So for me, that's that distinction, right? That outside person versus the inside person.
Well, I think what you guys are talking about is really interesting because when we think about the historical trauma, right, and the way in which our people have learned to survive these historical trauma and how it impacts our behaviors, it impacts the way that we think, and then it impacts the way we parent. What comes to mind is how our parents would always try to scare us of the outsiders in order to keep us in line. Right. And that, I mean, that doesn't relate to today's time because we are living in a country where we may not always feel as oppressed in that way. I mean, there certainly still is oppression, but just not in that same way of someone's going to come and take you away. And I wonder what your guys' thoughts are on that, because that's just an example, right? When we think about our parents trying to keep us alive, they're parenting us for survival. So, right? And that feels very threatening to Hmong Americans, where they're like, well, that's not a very effective way of parenting. But that was the way that they responded to historical trauma, because they did not want you to be taken away by the enemy, by the outsider.
As you were saying that, Dr. Lissa, I couldn't stop but smiling, right? Because it hit a point, because in session a lot of times when I'm working with people, I say this one term, what I call Hmong fear, okay? And this Hmong fear is this idea that oftentimes we need to be invisible, okay? And it's that trauma of being a submissive group in a dominant population where we need to be invisible. Right? You don't want to be noticed because, right, when we talk about that trauma, like I can imagine my siblings and my family running from enduring the war and trying to escape, right? And the idea that they had to be invisible is that learned traumatic response of what do we do, right? And now that we are in America here, for those groups that were here or those folks that early on in the 70s and 80s, they had the idea of, I need to be invisible. Mm-hmm. We don't rock the boat, right? Mm-hmm. And then that trauma response is, don't want to be seen, right? Because when we're seen, that exposes us. Mm-hmm. And if it's for the wrong reasons, that's going to cause problems. And so a lot of the times it's that Hmong fear. So our parents teach us, don't open the door, right? Mm-hmm. They teach us to not talk to people who don't look like us, right? And a lot of the times when oftentimes people talk about Asian people and being very silent and being very submissive, that's where it comes from, I believe. It's that traumatization of we're not the dominant group. And so we must stay silent.
That's really interesting what you said, because it reminds me of the fight or flight response, right? It takes us back to the basics of when we are subjected to traumatic situations, how do we assess the situation so that we do not die, so that we can survive? And it's you either fight, you flee, you freeze, or you fawn, right? And I think what you're talking about is we consider ourselves a small group of people. And so we can't fight because we're small in numbers. We can't flee because it's our homeland too. We can't freeze because, I mean, freezing is not living. And so we fawn. And fawning is, you know, the definition of fawning is really like to make yourself invisible, to go along with it so as to not create conflict. And so maybe psychologically speaking, that's what we've come to say. In order for us to survive as a race, as an ethnic group, we can't fight, we can't flee. So we must adapt, we must become invisible. We must create the least level of conflict so that we can exist without going into extinction, without being subjected to further traumatization and oppression.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. And it's making me think about intergenerational trauma now, mm-hmm. right? And how historical trauma impacts families, individuals, and now these traits then are being carried over into families. Where I think that for the most part, we can say that a lot of our Hmong families, we don't rock the boat, right? Like when there is conflict, even within, you know, clans, right? We tend to say, oh, just forget about it. Right? Because it'll actually be, I think, more scary to have an open conversation where you both can be assertive, right? Because that historically that has not been dealt well for us as a historical community, right? Like we can't be assertive. If we were to be assertive, we've actually been killed for mm-hmm. it.
Yeah. Well, and that reminds me of a quote, and it says, trauma decontextualized in a person looks like a personality. Right? Trauma decontextualized in a family looks like family traits. And trauma in a people looks like culture. So, Chu, what you're talking about is that we've thought about it as our cultural practices. We are a harmonious group of people. We are a collectivist group that prioritizes harmony. And so we don't rock the boat. We go along with it, but I almost wonder, as we're talking about trauma, if it starts to look like a culture because we had no other choice but to be invisible. We had no choice but to go along with it and not rock the boat so that we wouldn't be seen and so that we wouldn't be oppressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think for Hmong, our historical trauma really comes from war, mm-hmm. especially from the Vietnam War with being the most recent mm-hmm. Major traumatic event for our group or our community. Mm-hmm. It really impacted, I mean, depending on your age, right? Yeah. It really impacted, you know, your grandparents or your parents or to you mm-hmm. or and to your children. And so for grandparents who went through the war, you know, they parented their children in certain ways. And then the parents, you know, then parent their kids. But it really happens, I think, in a lot of unconscious ways that we don't even realize that shows up in our behaviors, that shows up in our emotions. Mm-hmm. That when something happens and it triggers us, we get angry or we project our anger or, you know, project ourselves towards our children. And they learn through that. And maybe that's, you know, a skill or something that they later on project to their children. Or mm-hmm. they're like, I didn't like how my parents did that because mm-hmm. that was, like we said earlier, traumatic in a way. Mm-hmm. And so they change their way of parenting.
Yeah. Well, and then I think another part that is also rooted in trauma is the orphan status and how traumatic it is, right? And what does that do for the individual, the sense of abandonment, the sense of need? If I'm an orphan and I feel abandoned and I feel unloved And I feel like I have no foundation. And I have this deep sense of need for love. And I've blocked out, you know, all of the pain. But deep down, unconsciously or subconsciously, there's this need to be loved, right? And then when I am older and I'm married, there's still this deep need. And if my spouse doesn't respond to my need, I get so mad. I get so mad, and I don't know why, but I go into a rage, and I don't know why, because I'm not aware of my own deep wounding from trauma, right? And so we talk about behavioral patterns at the parenting level. We also, it's important for us to talk about the behavioral patterns in relationships as well, too, and how it shows up. And I think the orphan one is a huge one that is highly traumatic, but we don't know how to deal with it.
I don't think I've shared this with a lot of people in my life, but the orphan story is a very, like, one of our Hmong narratives, right? And so the orphan story is always a really soft spot for me. Mm-hmm. And, like, I have two very wonderful parents in my life. Two sets now that I'm married. So I don't directly experience the orphan narrative. However, my father did, mm-hmm. and a lot of Hmong folks did. And I can see that trauma play out intergenerationally to me because I get emotional hearing mm-hmm. these stories. And it goes to show how, you know, trauma really gets passed down mm-hmm. genetically, emotionally yeah. to the next generation, yeah. whether it's if we directly witnessed it or experienced it, or we understand the history, the contextual piece mm-hmm. behind it mm-hmm. and how it continues to impact us. And I think with the orphan story, and, you know, they always say, like, oh, you know, it's always the, like, oh, like, you don't have parents, like, you know, an aunt or an uncle live with them, and then, like, they won't love you. And so there's, like, that fear-based conversation mm-hmm. again, too. Or you hear stories about, you know, the struggles that orphans had to experience because of the war, or even, you know, family separation because of war, right? I know there was, like, a recent video floating around about this mom reuniting with her daughter, and they're, like, much older now. The mom's probably, like, in her 70s, 80s, and the daughter's, like, 50s, 60s, and it's been, like, 30-plus years. Mm-hmm. And it's so bittersweet because it's, like, oh, like, this is such a beautiful moment, but it's so sad, too, because they've been separated mm-hmm. by force, by the violence that occurred in mm-hmm. our community that forced the separation. And so it just goes to speak to, you know, the nuances of the different traumas that Hmong people face.
Well, I also think that sometimes when you hear me and Joanna, you jimoplu na be Hmong lalo de jimoplu, right? You feel, I don't know if it's shame. I don't know what it is. Maybe just a lack of security. So there's no sense of security in guti, right, or nengcha, because you don't have that backbone. You don't have that foundation. And so sometimes there's a lot of insecurities that people carry as a result of those traumatic responses. And so the need to prove yourself is huge. Right? And sometimes there's that Hmong ho tia, oh, ni chi mo zi ma ni yo ju tau ji zi o, lo te lo teo te li na ne o. And again, that comes from culture, right? Cultural practices that we don't know if it's a matter of traumatic responses. But then what that messaging does to the orphan is, I have to engage in certain behaviors in order to prove myself. Right. And so there's that added pressure, that added stress that could lead to depression, that could lead to other mental health conditions as a result of it, too, because it's that deep seated messaging that has been planted into their mind that they have to act according to certain things. I want to move into talking a little bit about historical trauma as a collective trauma, right? So when we think about our Hmong history, we can all really relate to that. It's our refugee story. But what are some protective and risk factors that then separates that from getting passed to the next generation? Because as a collective, we experience trauma, but not everyone who's had that collective trauma then passes it down to their children. I'm talking more about the really significant and hurtful, harmful, traumatic events of drinking, alcohol, you know, drugs, abuse, right? All of that, because we know that that's at the intergenerational level, and that's also at the psychological level. So what are some protective or risk factors to name, to separate that out? Because the goal here is ultimately that we identify the pattern and we find ways to break that pattern. Because if we don't, it becomes epigenetics, right? Because research has shown that it does leave an imprint in our DNA. And then it becomes a genetic or a family history. So we have to somehow break that cycle.
Well, I mean, part of it is resiliency, right? I think that, you know, to some degree, some people just, you know, have a little bit more resiliency. And maybe that's, you know, due to temperament, all of those things, some biological factors. But some of it is also because they have more support, right? So if you think about, you know, as collectively, as a culture, we've all experienced this. But, you know, it's true. Some families don't repeat these patterns. And it's because their resiliency is different. And also they have different kind of supports happening where, you know, families are saying, you know, even though this is what we experience, this is not what we're going to pass on. They might even have more resources where, you know, now they're not in survival mode anymore, but they're trying to live in thriving mode, right? Much earlier on compared to some families. So I think that that's, I mean, I believe that that's what separates then, right? The differences is when you have that awareness and you've got supports going for you where you are now able to move towards changing from being in survival mode to now really thinking like, how do I live my life differently or a different way?
Dr. Alyssa, when you asked about risk factors and protective factors, I automatically thought about families, like what you said. Is that family, because as Hmong people, we're such a collectivist culture, like our friends are our family, our friends are our cousins. And so it makes me think about how that is one of our individually biggest, probably protective factor in our life, yet it can also be a risk factor in other ways too. Whether that's, you know, the influence of substance use, like with alcohol, as ways to cope with your depression or trauma that you experience or whatnot, if you use that as a coping skill versus, you know, the protective factor piece of, okay, like if you feel like you have no one left in this world, you still have your siblings, you still have your parents. If, you know, friends backstab you, like at the end of the day, you still have your family. And so I think that's like a really big protective factor that we hold. So it's kind of like almost like a double-edged sword in a way.
Well, when we talk about trauma from a Western perspective, it seems easily understood, like what we were saying earlier, right? Trauma is the pain that we experience from an incident, right? The overwhelming feeling and inability to cope with highly distressful circumstances. It's the psychological wounding from an event. It's not the event, but it's the psychological wounding. What is trauma in Hmong? Because that's also a peculiar and interesting thing when we try to treat trauma in therapy and we get Hmong clients come in. And of course, we have our own ideas of how we treat trauma, but the cultural piece adds another variable to it. And it can be a struggle because if we don't have the language for it, how do we treat it? Right. So in your mind, or just from your experience, Hmong hai trauma yarachi, how do we explain that in Hmong? How do we think through that?
I think that's the challenge of every therapist, every Hmong therapist or psychologist or, you know, therapeutic provider, because language has been such a big thing. It's like, how do we translate these westernized terms to conceptually make sense in our culture? Mm-hmm. Like, we had that conversation around what does depression mean to now what does trauma mean, right? Mm-hmm. And it makes me think about my experiences, you know, working with patients is, how do you break it down? And it often comes down to breaking down the symptoms of, okay, like, do you, you know, like, was there a time where you were frightened or got scared, you know, from an event or an incident or something that happened? To talking about symptoms like, oh, do you have nightmares? Do you have flashbacks? Like, when that occurred. Mm-hmm. And it's like challenging because it's, oh, you just want a term in the Hmong language that will be easy for your patients to be like, yep, that's what I'm experiencing. So oftentimes it's like, oh, how do I break it down in a way where it connects to them? It's what they're experiencing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to be so descriptive in our Hmong language because there isn't a term for trauma. Right. So that's what I was just thinking is I do a lot of that in my sessions too.
Yeah. And I think the part that is hard is like, we want a catch-all, mm-hmm. right? Like a word like trauma, but for, I think for Hmong people, every experience with pain, right? When we talk about the definition of trauma, every experience with pain looks different. Right? If we were to just say, oh, como shelo, or if we talk about physical something, every experience we have as Hmong people, it gets translated physically or mentally or emotionally differently in terms of pain. So when even we talk about yaitia kucheng na yo, that's sometimes more panicky or more like something startled me, right? Mm-hmm. Or if we talk about geting chai, that's more fear-based or something like that. And that's, I think that part is really hard because when we talk about trauma and the way we talk about it from a Hmong perspective, it looks different to everyone.
Yes, agree 100% with what you guys are saying. And as you're talking, right, Geng then implies that our body was affected by the traumatic experience. So, and so that is the way that the Hmong people come to understand trauma, because as Bessel van der Kolk says in his book, right, the body keeps the score. I think that the Hmong people are really good at connecting the body to the psychological piece. And so, but then there's another piece, the spiritual piece, because that's also trauma. Right? It talks about the spiritual piece of it. And in fact, a Native American mental health provider by the name of Dr. Eduardo Duran calls it the soul wound. And what he says is that the trauma goes to a place where no blood flows, which is, I think, is pretty deep, and it's really relevant to our Hmong community, is that when you have trauma that is so deep and goes to a place where no blood flows, that's our spiritual side. And so that's why Bei Mong the idea, oh, Nu Bong Pli Le, Yu Chu Tao Hu Pli. But yeah. And so that's when we do the soul calling ceremony, because the trauma has touched a place that that blood doesn't flow to. But if the trauma goes to where the body or the blood flows to, then we can sai jiang, tian nao chuo hao chuo. But what about domestic violence and sexual abuse? Because that's trauma in the Western definition. But we don't say, oh, ni tong tu zin dao, ni tong tu pan yan dao wei, ni jiang le. We don't say that. It's just weird to say it in Hmong when we think of it that way.
It's because it's a taboo topic in our culture.
All right. Yeah. So say more.
We don't talk about it.
And we should, right?
Yes.
But how? Like, is it that we don't talk about it and that's why we don't have a place for it? Because Samoa, right?
It's uncomfortable, right? But it's, we need to begin having the dialogue about it. And yes, makatsamoa, right? There's the shame, the embarrassment behind it. You know, a lot of survivors and victims, it's like their experiences are minimized or invalidated. They're unheard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of our community pushes it under the rugs and doesn't talk about it. But it happens. It happens in all communities. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and how do we say it, right? When something like that happens in Hmong, what do we say? Whereas, like, I don't know if that's right, right? Let's, you know, and I think that some of that historical trauma where when things aren't pretty, when things aren't right, it's let's be invisible. That default motive, let's be invisible. Let's not rock the boat. Let's not do things to break the harmony, right? And although it's really sad when we don't talk about it, because these are very negative experiences mm-hmm. that somebody is going through to the point of traumatization. And for Hmong people, it's let's not rock the boat.
But would the Hmong people identify abuse, sexual, physical, emotional abuse as wounding to the individual? Because the other types of trauma is wounding either to the spiritual side or to the physical side, right? But if there's abuse, would the people say, oh, yeah, or do they completely just gloss over it because they can't even, like Hua says, it's so taboo that they're not even think about the wounding, the damage that it does?
You know, what I've seen back in my work in child protection is that, like, okay, it's not talked about, but there are actions being done sometimes. Mm. Is where if a sexual abuse occurs, the mom with, like, a child, right? Yeah. The mom might not talk about it with their child ever, but finds ways to physically protect the child, meaning, okay, we'll always be in the room or make sure, you know, someone that is safe is in the room with the child, or that the child doesn't make contact. I've seen this, you know, happen before, like, okay, even though we don't talk about it, it doesn't mean that nothing's also being done.
Because implied in that is that, yes, it is not good.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it does do harm.
Mm-hmm.
But let's navigate through this in a more peaceful way
mm-hmm.
to protect the situation, because we don't want the individual to be subjected to more harm. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Or protect the group, right? Right? So we protect the family, we protect the group, we protect we protect the name in which grandma and grandpa may have that was given to us. So we protect the perpetrator, right?
Mm.
But then we don't rock the boat. But yet we mm-hmm. will make adjustments
mm-hmm.
within life, within situations to protect that one individual may have been harmed.
Yep.
But let's not rock the boat so much that other people would know.
Because maybe that perpetrator is, like what you said, family. And you know how family is so important to the Hmong culture.
But I think that we do need to bring it to the light to talk about, because from our professional area, that's what we would consider chronic trauma or complex trauma, right? And we know that when we have trauma that is longstanding, complex, such as abuse, especially longstanding abuse, right? Child abuse, sexual abuse, that's happened over the course of a very long period of time, and that's trauma, that it affects the individual's ability to navigate the world, because that's when they start to doubt whether or not the world is safe. So now they can't even trust that they can make sound decisions. And so what we find in individuals who's gone through pretty significant trauma of abuse is that they can't function in the gray. They have to function in the black and the white, right? Because they don't know, let's say, for example, if you're a child who's been sexually abused by your stepfather or stepmother, right? Or even your biological parent, you begin to feel like, wait, like what we talked about with the attachment, this person is supposed to protect me, but this person is hurting me. So now I don't even know, is it me? Was I bad? Did I do something? And so if this person is supposed to be the safest person, but is not safe, then what does that mean about the whole world? I can't trust if people outside of this is safe, right? So then they struggle with that. What are some examples that you guys might think about that makes it very hard for individuals who've gone through pretty complex trauma navigating the grays? Because we see that in our, experiences, is that it's very hard for them to read the nuances of social cues, to read the nuances of situations.
I think for me, what comes to mind when you're talking about that is very much how for Hmong people we internalize, right? And so when we leave that trauma untalked about or untouched, we oftentimes don't realize the impact it has across the family or a collective group. And when we talk about protecting that family member who might be doing things to a family member, a lot of time it's that we fall into this basic mode of surviving, and we forget that how harmful it can be when the whole family can't live their best life because of trauma. Because one individual is impacted, and that individual's impact will affect mom, dad, brother, and sister. And we shut down and we internalize and we don't talk about things and we don't treat that trauma, or we don't give it attention enough. And so the whole family suffers. And that part is, I think sometimes when you talk about needing to talk about these things, I think that's where it goes, right? How do we talk about these things so that the family can heal?
But it's so taboo that it's very, but you're right. One of the key ways to heal or work through it is to name it and to talk through it. And that's the first step. Yeah. You mentioned something that I want to go back to, because I think it's really important to mention, because it goes back to the historical trauma, the collective experience, and then also the intergenerational trauma that requires a lot of healing. And I think this is something that, as a refugee person myself, I've pondered over for a very long time. Because when we think about trauma, we always think about what happened to you that should not have happened to you. The harm that has inflicted upon you, either by another person or by an incident or an event, and it should not have happened. But as a refugee child growing up, you think, wait, my parents weren't abusive. But why do I still carry the trauma with me, right? And so then we think about what should have happened that didn't happen. And that's equally traumatic, meaning that if you have a parent who is struggling with their own historical trauma, intergenerational trauma, psychological trauma, and they are depressed or anxious, and they are showing up in ways that doesn't respond to your needs, right? And you are left to fend for yourself, then that's where what should have happened that didn't happen can be equally traumatizing to an individual, right? So it goes, again, it kind of goes back to connecting all of those patterns. And if you have a parent who couldn't respond to your needs because of their own depression and their own traumatic history, what does that do for that next generation?
And I think when we talk about Hmong people, right, over the course of what's happened over the last 100 years, that is such an important conversation, because 100 years ago, what a parent had to worry about is so different than what a parent today has to worry about. And I think for our Hmong people, that idea of surviving impacted parenting so much that it impacts the way we carry that generational trauma. And I think we are finally at a place for many of us to have a home, right? To have consistency, to have our own, not necessarily our own country, but a country we can belong to enough to where we can say we have stability, to where we can heal and we can say, you know, from a psychological perspective, we can start working on those traumas, or mm-hmm. we can start mm-hmm. trying to prevent or stop the passing of generational trauma.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we're there?
I think we're starting, right? I think when we see how important mental health has become in our community, you can't be but hopeful, right? That from generation to generation, we are starting to have the awareness mm-hmm. to prevent the passing of that generational trauma, right? In my parents' generation, they didn't have the time to stop and say, in what I am doing, am I potentially passing harm down to my children? Whereas I think now we can sit here and have a conversation and think, be like, oh yeah, this behavior of mine, mm-hmm. it can make my kid anxious, or it can cause depression in my children. Whereas in our parents' generation, in our grandparents' generation, if they didn't work two jobs, or if they didn't work to put food on a table or to feed the family or have a house or put clothes on our backs, that's all they can think about. They were truly in that survivor mode, and that's part of the that trauma that it was part of our culture, because we were working so hard to survive that now we have that privilege to think about mm-hmm. our mental health and to send kids to therapy or to put kids in activity or mm-hmm. education, right? And that's where knowledge truly comes to be power.
Maybe I'm just a little skeptical or more pessimistic in the sense that, you know, yes, we're here in the US, we have more interventions and access to resources. However, we're still a minoritized group. You know, we're still experiencing racial trauma with the height of COVID and anti-Asian hate. Like, that's not a new form of trauma, but that's, you know, a trauma that our children and we have to experience, and how to address that now, you know, in a way where we don't pass that intergenerationally, that trauma down to the next generations.
I think that's a great point. Because even though we've spent a lot of time talking about our past collective trauma. We have some current collective trauma, which is the anti-Asian sentiments and the racial tension in this country. So I'm curious what collective healing might look like if we're thinking about our group as a historically marginalized group and continues to be, but we need to somehow move towards some form of collective healing. Like, what might that look like?
I honestly don't know. But I do believe that, you know, it's like you said earlier, Dr. Alyssa, we have to start talking about it, right? Because that's the only way to really process or heal from our trauma. And I think that, you know, going through collective trauma together, that's, I mean, I've seen it. You know, there are support groups out there where they're saying, let's have a conversation about this. Let's talk about this. And the best thing that we can do for our kids is to also talk about it with them. Because if we're experiencing it as grownups and we're trying to make sense of it, and we're having our outlets to talk about it, right? But we're not giving that space to our kids. That's then where I think that, you know, those intergenerational trauma patterns can be passed down. Because now I'm doing something and my child has no understanding of why I'm doing what I'm doing. Yet if I can have a conversation with my child that talks about, this is what's happening in the world, or this is what's happening in the home, I'm allowing space for my child to make meaning with me. And so, you know, I think it speaks to what you were asking earlier too about, you know, what should have been done but wasn't, and now it's traumatizing, right? Which is that I don't think that we've had the privilege, like Mosey said, to really make meaning with our kids before in the past, or, you know, our parents and grandparents, right? Because it's a lot of times survival mode. But now we have that opportunity to have that conversation.
Right. And I think having that conversation is really important. And I think now more than ever, when we talk about collective healing, I think I see that conversation happening more, whether it is mental health in the schools, whether it is mental health in our music and our art, right?
Yes, definitely.
Or when we talk about how cool it is to go somewhere and see a shirt that talks about positive mental health, right? So I think it's when we talk about that collective healing, right? It begins with one voice, to another, right? And when we start seeing it happen, occur more and more, right? Whether it is the way we tell stories, whether it is social media, whether it is that awareness from a younger generation to trying to impact, you know, the 30s or 40-year-olds to having 50 or 60-year-olds understand that not everything ends with genyoshia, right? And I think the more and more we are willing to have a conversation, that collective healing begins. When we start to break down and talk about how do we change the patriarchal society that we come from, or how do we break away from that collective society where we always protect the bad parts of our society or our communities and our culture. And it really comes down to that concept of keeping what's great and taking those things that are bad, right, that impacts our mental health, and trying to improve those things.
Yeah, Mosey, when you're speaking, you know, it makes me think about how, yes, you know, we need to have these types of conversation and in a way normalize it to our community. Not saying that, okay, it's okay that we're being traumatized, or it's okay that, you know, we're experiencing these bad things, but to normalize that, yes, abuse happens in all communities. Yes, trauma can occur to anyone. Yes, we can all experience mental health. It doesn't pick and choose an individual. And I think when we normalize it, it makes us not feel so isolated, not feel so alone, like we have to figure it out ourselves, or we have to feel shame, or have to keep it hush hush. And like what you said, Chu, we begin to process it then, and we begin to heal from what has happened to us.
So thank you for the the comments on collective healing, and I want to move into more of a individual healing and the work there. But before we go into that, I want to talk a little bit about how a person copes when they've been exposed to trauma, right? Because it's important that we name some of the maladaptive coping mechanisms when an individual has been exposed to perhaps chronic trauma, like abuse, going back to that. And because of, you know, the fight and flight response, if you're a child, or if you're a weaker of the two or of the party, and you are being harmed in a very traumatic way, in a very abusive way, the fight or flight response says you either fight, you either flee, you either freeze, or you either fawn, right? And oftentimes, if you can't fight it because you're smaller, if you can't outrun it because you're smaller, to freeze, sometimes it doesn't work because you're still being attacked. And so oftentimes we know that people then go into what we would call dissociating, disconnecting, blocking out, because that's the only way that they can cope with something that is so traumatizing to them. And what we find is that what was adaptive in those moments in order to survive, as you get older, becomes a maladaptive strategy. And when we see adults who are struggling with their interpersonal relationships, who are struggling in their life because they're still using the same skills to cope with stress, to cope with highly distressful situations, traumatic, triggering situations, we find that it's actually more hurtful for them, right, in their adult life, while it was very helpful to them in their child life. Yeah, I just wanted to name that because I think it's important that we recognize that. And I think it's important that individuals who are struggling in their adult life become aware of that. You can't keep using the same skills because you're not in the same situation anymore. Right?
Yeah, very true. Yeah, I definitely think that that's true. And, you know, there are so many coping behaviors that can come from trauma, right? So dissociation is one, substance abuse. Mm-hmm. There is, you know, aggression. There's internalization stuff mm-hmm. happening that, you know, in some form of context, yes, it was helpful at one point in your life. Now, though, if there isn't the trauma that's being presented, or there isn't a problem or fear that's being presented, then it becomes very maladaptive to that person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What would be an example of that?
Example of
a coping mechanism that was useful and no longer useful.
Yeah. So, I mean, what I think about is that I'll talk about internalizing, right? Because mm-hmm. I think that we see that a lot with within our community mm-hmm. is that we tend to kind of shut down and go within ourselves mm-hmm. when a problem presents itself or a trauma presents, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe when I was young and my parents were, you know, being big and scary, or there's DV stuff happening, domestic violence stuff happening, it was, you know, actually very good that I tapped into internalizing, because the smaller I was, the less ruckus I probably created mm-hmm. and the less of a target I become mm-hmm. in my parents' fight. Mm-hmm. However, as I age, okay, and I'm growing into an adult now, and if I am in a situation where my fear gets triggered in the same way that I was in the situation as my childhood. So for example, maybe I'm gonna go take a test, or, you know, like it's yeah. something that's very small, right? But that's the thing about trauma, is that it shifts mm-hmm. our perspective. And so it's something very small that, you know, it's very normal to have anxiety about.
Right.
Now it's tapping my anxiety to be triggered where I'm thinking worst case scenario is going to happen. Mm-hmm. There's going to be conflict. And so I am getting so, I get triggered and I am internalizing so much that now it's affecting the way I perform on my test.
Because you're shutting down.
Yes, because I'm shutting down.
Run towards the stressor that you should be running towards because you can't avoid it.
Yeah. And that's when it becomes maladaptive.
Right. Yeah. That's a great example.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that, you know, as we're talking about coping mechanisms and maladaptive coping mechanisms and really moving towards what then could we do differently, right? I want to highlight one hopeful thing is that because trauma is not what happened, it's not the event, because we can't change the event, right? We can't change what has happened to us. We can't take back what already happened. But because trauma is the psychological wounding, the pain that we experience, then I think it feels very hopeful because it's sort of like a wound that we've sustained, but and we know that with wounds, mm-hmm. we can work through it, right? When we think about physical wounds, if you, you know, fall off the bike and scrape your knee, that's a wound that you can fix. If you break your arm, that's a wound that you can fix. And I think in the same way, when we have some psychological wounding due to a traumatic event, it's the pain and the wound that we can work through. And so I'm curious about healing because healing is another one of those words that we're using a lot here in the community and social media, self-healing, right? And so can we spend a few minutes talking about what that means so that we're putting a more of a clinical focus on what does it mean to heal from trauma?
That's a big question. Right?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to heal from trauma? When we talk about that healing, for me, a lot of it is exploring behaviors that comes along with that pain. So like when Chu talk about those maladaptive coping that occurs, it's also about how do we process and talk about those maladaptive behaviors that we learn from trauma or those traumatic experiences, and how do we give ourselves that permission to really be ourselves by talking about it, by addressing it, right? About us talking about these painful things that sometimes it's really harmful for us to revisit or for really harmful for us to think about. And I think when we talk about healing, it truly begins with that awareness and that ability to say, you know, I could be safe, right? Or the idea that I don't have to only survive or be on basic needs or work so hard towards that. And sometimes we have to give ourselves permission that we could get there and that we can do the work to get there.
I think when we're talking about healing, in my mind, especially specific to trauma, because healing can come in many ways, but because this episode focuses on trauma, when we think about trauma and the wounding that it does to us psychologically, and when we think about interventions treating trauma, right? We often think about the separation between or the disconnect between our body and our emotions, right? And sometimes there's a separation between the right brain and the left brain as well, too. So there's a lot of disconnect when it comes to traumatic wounds. And that's why a lot of the psychologists often talk about the fragmentation, right, of the psyche. Because that's what trauma does. So I think to me, healing is really the trying to connect the disconnect, trying to repair the disconnect. And so that healing is the coming together of that whole self. And if we can somehow move through that and work through that and connect the emotions from the body so that we feel grounded in who we are, in our authentic self, right? To me, that's healing. How do we connect those fragmented pieces of who we are? So what are some recommendations or tips that you might want to share to help begin that process of healing? And we know that it's not easy with working on healing trauma. So we're not saying these tips are going to do it. These tips are just to help you out, but really you do need therapy to do the healing, the hard, deeper healing. But I think some tips might be helpful and useful for individuals to be mindful of as well, too. So what are some of those tips?
I think one of the biggest tips I introduce to individuals that I work with when they're triggered or experience trauma is how to reground themselves through different grounding techniques. And it could be something really simple as like deep breathing, like, okay, just take some deep breaths, feel the cool air going into your nostrils and then the warm breath coming out, and to really like use your senses to remind you to be here in the now, be present, and literally be grounded, be present in the now, that so that, you know, you're not feeling like you're in imminent danger. Or it could look like, you know, taking a hot shower and just listening to the shower run and, you know, feel it. Like you're really using those senses that we have. Or tasting something sweet or smelling something fresh. Something that is enjoyable for us to remind us that, hey, we're not perfect. We're not happy, but we're okay. And that's enough.
So I would, you know, like what you said, Hawaii, I do typically encourage, you know, do like the regulation work, right? The grounding work. And then I think it's also nice to also be curious and explore too more about your patterns, right? And, you know, maybe that might be hard, especially if you're just starting to be curious about your own behaviors. But I think that that's where the fun work really begins. Because once you start having awareness of what you're doing, it's almost like you start catching yourself more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, this is like a process that we want people to do in therapy. But, you know, if we're thinking like if you're just curious and, you know, you're not really in a place yet where you want to tap into therapy, definitely like grounding mm-hmm. and then just being curious and start noticing, like, do you have patterns? And, you know, when you're noticing those patterns, is it related to trauma then, right?
Right. Yeah. That mindfulness, mm-hmm. right? So that as earlier when you were talking about the example with the child who's internalizing, and as an adult, they're taking a test or, you know, their child is fallen and hurt. Something mm-hmm. stressful, not necessarily traumatic, but it triggers those old wounds, right? Mm-hmm. And when it triggers those old wounds, the individual might want to go into their old coping mechanism, which was adaptive when mm-hmm. their parents were fighting. And so they kind of shut down, they kind of internalize, they block off the world. But that's not helpful to that test they have to pass. That's mm-hmm. not helpful to that child they have to run towards and help. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that mindfulness of why am I shutting down mm-hmm. when I'm supposed to be running to my child, and that, and then being aware of that and then being mindful that, oh, it's because it worked for me mm-hmm. when my parents were being big and scary. But I can't do that as a parent. Mm-hmm. I can't do that as a student. I can't do that at my job. It's not going to work for me. So I have to recognize the pattern, and then I have to do something to mm-hmm. change the pattern. Mm-hmm.
What happens when something we have to do is avoidance? There's a certain place that triggers me or a certain something that bothers me. Wow. I avoid it.
That's a pattern too, right? And so to me, when you ask that, it's like, well, are you avoiding a place that, like Chu said earlier, you fed in your mind that it's big and scary because of your old traumatic experiences? You think that it's a life or death situation, right? And that's not traumatic, but in your mind, it feels like the end of the world. And so you want to avoid that place. To me, that is a maladaptive coping skill, because the avoidance now is being reinforced. And the more you avoid, the more you're not going to be able to work through that maladaptive skill. So you have to assess, is that situation that you're avoiding only scary in your mind because of your traumatic past or your traumatic experiences? Or is it truly scary? And if it's not scary, then you have to recognize it and you have to push yourself through and go and subject yourself to the anxiety. Because what we know about healing is that we have to be able to be vulnerable enough, not only to recognize our patterns, to name our patterns, but to also commit to working through it. And that vulnerability sometimes is really hard, because if we're someone who's had a lot of trauma, we might not have a very high threshold to manage stress. So one of the biggest things we do in therapy, when someone comes in and they are easily triggered, highly anxious because of a long history of trauma, is we hold space for them to tolerate negative emotions so that they can increase that threshold. Because if they can't increase that threshold, they're not going to be able to pass that test, finish that project at work, or help their child. I know this is a huge topic. We probably jumped around a lot because there is so much to cover. And if any of you have any questions, any comments, we would love to hear them. We would love to hear your feedback on this topic of trauma that is big and heavy. And we may revisit at another point too, but we hope that this topic has been helpful to those of you who have listened, to reflect on your own trauma history, perhaps to reflect on the trauma history of your people, perhaps of your parents. And I hope that this helps you to reconcile with some of that trauma, to notice some of those patterns and to work through them with the support of a positive support system. So thank you all for joining us, and we will see you next time. Goodbye.